Welcome, everybody. This is the third office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Government Intervention. It is May 10th, 2014, and I'm actually in Florida, which is why the background is different here. Okay, so as always, guys, for those of you who are tuned in live here, if you want to go ahead and post some questions, I'll jump in. While you guys are thinking, let me just mention, lately, for those of you who have not been following my blog, and why would you not take advantage of such a wonderful opportunity that's free, but it's at consultingbyrpn.com. I've been just going nuts on this Thomas Piketty, I think that's how you pronounce his name, the French economist, who's the author of the book Capital in the 21st Century, and it's, I don't know if it still is right now, but for a period in April, at least, it was literally the number one bestseller on Amazon. You know, not among economics or finance books, but just overall, number one bestseller. And Krugman has been going nuts. Robert Solow was saying how great it was, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, the book is just absolutely horrifying. And I didn't realize how bad it was until last night, but up until... It's a thick book. It's like 670 pages, something like that. I haven't read the whole thing, but I've been reading extensively from various sections where I thought, okay, let me see if this guy knows what he's talking about. So up until last night, I had just been seeing he doesn't know the first thing about the intricacies in terms of what's called capital and interest theory. But so I've been hammering that. So if you're curious, I'm imagining a lot of you are fans of the Austrian School of Economics, and in this course, we don't get into that too much. You know, a lot of the stuff I say is kind of the standard free market things with an Austrian flavor, but where the Austrian School really shines in terms of the history of economic thought into the present day is their rich understanding of the capital structure. And so that, like, if you ever bump into somebody who says, hey, I love Milton Friedman and stuff, and the Chicago School guys are great, why do you care about the Austrian stuff? What do they have that these other schools don't? Among other things, the Austrian approach to capital, what's called capital theory, is different. And when it comes to this guy's book, it takes Austrians to really knock this guy down because he's relying on a theoretical structure that only somebody versed in the Austrian perspective on capital theory is really going to be able to unpack. But anyway, beyond that, it's, in case you don't know, I mean, this guy, it explains why his book is so popular, because he goes through this historical analysis, comes up with some back-of-the-envelope arguments as to why the share of capitalists in national income is going to keep getting bigger and bigger at the expense of labor. And then his conclusion, which I just hit last night, which horrified me, is that he's calling for a global tax on capital. And I had just, I mean, I knew that going into it because that's what people were saying, but I had just assumed the point was to fund social programs or something, you know, to give money to poor people or something. No, he explicitly said the purpose of having confiscatory levels of taxation is not to redistribute income. It's not so that you can have more money in the government coffers to spend on poor people. He said the purpose is to get rid of those high incomes and estates. In other words, with confiscatory levels of taxation of 80% or above in place, no one's going to bother generating an income of $1 million a year because they know the government's going to take 80% of it. And he says that is the purpose. So it's not even, oh, gee, there's people out there with a lot of money. We could do a lot better with that stuff than having them spend it on yachts. No, the mentality is, whoa, there's a lot of people out there with private jets and yachts. I don't want them to exist. They should not be allowed to have that stuff because that's not fair. I mean, that's his mentality. It is just utterly repugnant. Okay, but if you want to see more of that, you can go to my blog. And Jan asks in the comments here, who actually buys a thick book like that? The other thing, too, is what I just discovered yesterday. I mean, I knew over the last few weeks as I was reading the real technical stuff, that he doesn't understand the nuances of what determines the real interest rate and how do you determine the earnings of capitalists and things like that. He commits some very naive mistakes that Bumbaver, who was came after Karl Menger but before Mises, literally blew apart in the late 1800s. I mean, so that's what I mean when it's just shocking that this guy is putting forth fallacies that have literally been blown up that long ago. But beyond that, what I just hit yesterday was he makes basic mistakes in his history, saying, like he said, for example, that the top U.S. federal income tax rate got brought down to 25% by the late 1920s under the disastrous Herbert Hoover administration. And then when FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt, got elected and came into office in 1933, one of his first priorities was to raise the top income tax rate to 63%. This is what this Piketty guy is saying in his analysis, his historical analysis. The problem is that's totally wrong. The top income tax rate was brought down to 25% under Calvin Coolidge, and it happened in 1925. Herbert Hoover wasn't sworn in until 1929. Okay, so he's off by 4 years in the president. And then the rate was raised from 25% to 63% in one fell swoop, but it happened in 1932 under Herbert Hoover. Okay, FDR didn't come into office and jack up the top tax rate because Herbert Hoover already had done so. So in addition to just being totally wrong, like that if you turn that in, if you were an econ major and had a term paper and put that in, you'd get a big fat F because you can't even go to Wikipedia and get your basic history right. Beyond that mistake, notice it's not an arbitrary mistake. It fits his narrative that he wants, because his whole point is we got to have progressive people in office who care about the poor, and that the reason that the upper 1% do so well is because of all these, you know, business friendly supply side kind of Chicago school types who've been running things. And that's why we need to have a progressive revolution, not revolution like Marxist revolution, but okay. So it's not just that his basic history is wrong. It's that it's very conveniently wrong that it serves his narrative. And then somebody else caught him again, just making stuff up when it comes to the history of the US minimum wage law, that Piketty says, you know, it stagnated under Ronald Reagan and George Bush, and then Bill Clinton raised it, and then under George W. Bush it stagnated, and then Barack Obama. And no, he's just off by several years in his analysis. It's not that the minimum wage was stagnant under Republicans, and then when Democrats came in it was raised. I mean, he's just making stuff up. It's just astonishing. But to answer your question, Janet, where I'm going with that is you're saying, well, who buys a book? So what I'm trying to get at is, I have seen leftist economists who will acknowledge that, yeah, there are some theoretical issues with Piketty's book. You know, there are some subtleties in what's called the Cambridge Capital Controversy, and he kind of glides over those. But overall, the thesis holds up very well. Nobody has admitted, yeah, it's true. There's a few places in the book where he just makes stuff up. And so my guess is that nobody really sat down and read the thing cover to cover, because you would think they would either keep their mouth shut or they would sort of, you know, bring it up and say, well, yeah, this is awkward, but, you know, he's in France and maybe the way they do their tax system is different, so maybe that's why he's consistently off by a year. Who knows? But anyway, in any event, I'm trying to think of it, you know, I guess if I had gotten a book from somebody who was saying something that I really agreed with, and I saw that the guy was just completely botching historical facts, what would I do? I don't know. I guess that maybe I'd keep my mouth shut. I certainly wouldn't praise the book highly and just ignore that stuff, I guess. So who knows? It's just, the whole thing is astonishing. And just wait till you guys see, and I'm not telling you to go read the book, obviously, but I'm going to just put in some quotes. It is astonishing, his proposal. He wants governments around the world to share financial information such that we can implement this global tax on capital. So in order to do that, all the governments have to be involved and it has to be coordinated up, because otherwise you would just take your capital and, you know, move it to a tax haven. And so he wants there to be this thing. So anytime you like make a deposit in a bank, he wants that information to get transmitted to all the governments of the world, so they all have tabs and know exactly how much your net worth is. So it's not just that your government needs to know how wealthy you are. He wants every government around the world to know everything about your finances. Again, not because they're going to take it from you so they can help poor people, but just because so they can make sure you don't get too much, because we don't want to live in a world where some people have too much. I mean, it is the most horrifying. Okay, I'll stop. Jan says, the Czech Minister of Agriculture recently said that while food was more expensive in Germany than in the Czech Republic, it is much better quality, and Germans actually save money because of that. Unfortunately, Czech supermarkets don't offer good quality food and therefore lead people to buy cheap food. So what he will do is make supermarkets offer better quality food, which according to him happens to be grown in the Czech Republic as opposed to China or Poland. What's wrong with this thinking? Okay, well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's wrong, but I'm just rereading to make sure I'm getting the players correct and seeing what the argument is. Yeah, I mean, it's in general, Jan, when people berate, how can I put it? It's a general theme that interventionists don't like the market outcome, and they will say, oh, these consumers are so short-sighted and petty, all they care about is low prices, and they don't care about quality, they don't care about loyalty to a firm, they don't care about, you know, geez, well, so the idea is businesses in a free market have no choice but to cater to the lowest common denominator. So it's kind of deal like in the U.S., there was airline deregulation, so I don't know if everybody knows this, but in the 1970s, air travel was, there was price fit controls, all right? And so the government, it was illegal for airlines to undercut each other by offering cheaper prices, right? Off the top of my head, I don't remember the exact nature of the regulation, but the point was they did not have total freedom of pricing. However, there were, and so that's why you saw, if you guys are familiar with this, there was a sort of stereotype that stewardesses, you know, the people when you get on the plane that like help you get seated and then bring you your, you know, drinks and peanuts and whatever, that they were really good looking. They were, you know, physically attractive originally, and now that doesn't seem to be, you know, a thing anymore, whereas at one point it seemed like. And the explanation for that is they deregulated airline traffic. Okay, so it was, I think they started doing it like in the late 70s, and then under the Reagan administration, they totally phased it out. And so what happened is now the airlines were allowed to compete on price. And so prices came way down. So the point was, originally, and I'm going into this because it's directly relevant to the, you know, we just covered price control. And so when the businesses, what it was is there was a minimum floor set. So normally we talk about a minimum price in terms of labor and the minimum wage, but in this case, it might strike you as unusual, but they were setting a minimum wage or a minimum price on airline tickets, that it was illegal for, you know, Delta to cut prices on this route from LA to New York, because that wouldn't be fair. You know, that would undercut the whole industry, and they needed to keep prices up in order to keep air travel profitable. That was the mentality. All right, so. But the airlines still wanted to compete with each other. And so the deal was, well, gee, how are we going to get more customers? We can't offer cheaper ticket prices. So what can we do? Well, one thing they do is they would hire really attractive stewardesses to be, you know, the employees on the flight, because at that time still a lot of the travelers were men who were going on business trips. You know, families didn't go to Disney World a lot, you know, back in the 1970s, because it was expensive. So the average person wasn't just hopping on a plane to visit grandma. It was more men, just stereotypically, traveling on business. All right. And so that was one way they could be. And also, you would get, you know, nice meals and things like that. Whereas now when you travel, you know, people complain, like, oh, I get jammed in there and I feel like a sardine, and they just give me a drink. They might not even give me peanuts anymore. You know, what happened? But it's because they're competing on price, and that's what people want. And so a skeptic or a cynic will say, oh, yeah, these consumers, they don't care about anything else. All they care about is giving you the cheapest price, and that leads to consequences. The airlines will cater to that desire. So one thing, Jan, is just to say, well, if that's what the consumers want, then who is the Czech Minister of Agriculture to contradict them? Okay, so if it really is the case that consumers should be eating higher quality food, you know, maybe it's organic or something like that, it's more expensive. Well, if that's what they want to spend their money on, then they'll do that, and that's what the market will provide. Okay, so, I mean, wherever you fall, there's always a spectrum. There's always a spectrum of trade-offs. There's different, you know, there's some groceries. I don't know how it is in the Czech Republic, but in the United States it's like this, where there's some stores that are really what you call high-end or luxury. And so everything in there is more expensive, but it's a really nice store. Just the facilities are very beautiful, and there's a lot of fancy food. You know, there's like specialty items in the deli and things. You can get sushi that's real fresh and everything, or pasta dishes, and it just looks really nice. And there's not a lot of line, but it's more expensive. And then there's like a more middle of the road grocery store. And then if you really want to save money, you go to Walmart. But the problem with Walmart is it's humongous. You know, so if you just want to get peanut butter, if you're out of eggs, you don't want to go to Walmart because it's going to take you 15 minutes just to get back there. And then when you come back, depending on the time of day, there might be a 15-minute line, right? So whereas if you go to one of those high-end grocery stores, it's a smaller physical building, and so you can get in and get the eggs really fast, and there's not a big line because it's expensive. Okay, so the point is, by having those options, you can go to whichever combination you want. And notice, even at Walmart, it's not like there's a store where if a customer vomits on the floor, the vomit just sits there. I mean, no matter what store you're in, if there's something like, or somebody spills milk and it's all over the floor, they're always going to have a maintenance person come and clean it up right away. You know what I mean? So there's always minimum standards of quality. Or if there's meat that's sitting out, you know, that's spoiled, they're going to try to get rid of that really fast and not let a customer buy meat that's actually unsafe. Okay, so the point is, there's always a spectrum of trade-offs, and in a genuine competitive market, a lot of options and variety will already be available, so people can go to whatever they want. And so if the Minister of Agriculture or somebody comes in and just arbitrarily says, no, we're going to raise the minimum standard of excellence, and so, well, people can only buy, you know, produce that's grown locally or within 30 miles, and that means tomatoes are now going to be 20% more expensive, but at least, you know, it'll be higher. But, well, you can let consumers make that decision. So in general, Jan, I would say that there is a trade-off, and it's true. And so a lot of people, like in the United States, there's this store called Whole Foods. And it's real hip, and like a lot of progressive people who are real, you know, in their 20s, they'll go to the Whole Foods because the food is, it's more organic and natural, and but it's really expensive. They joke and they call it whole paycheck because it takes your whole paycheck to just do your shopping there. And so, but I don't go there because it's not worth it to me right now. If I doubled my income, I'd probably start going there. But right now, with all the stuff, you know, and I want to accumulate gold and silver coins or whatever, because I think the economy is going to crash, to me, it's like, nah, but I don't go to Walmart either, because it's not as nice. You feel, it looks like depressing to go in there because it's so big, and But there are other people who don't have as much money as I do, and they do go to Walmart. And it would be awful to force them to go to the store I go to, because then they'd pay a little bit more. They would rather wait in line in the checkout and save money, whereas my time, to me, is more valuable than that. I would rather pay a little bit more but not have to spend 15 minutes waiting in line. So, and all these times when these people want to restrict options, they always will cite. In other words, nobody is going to just come out and say blatantly, yeah, we're going to put this measure in place to make consumers pay more so that our farmers can get more money, because we think that money should be taken out of consumers' pockets and put in the hands of the farmers. No one's going to say that. They're always going to try to make it look like it's a win-win. But yeah, we're going to boost incomes for our farmers, but also consumers are going to get higher quality. And so, again, the point is, if that's really a good thing to do and consumers really are going to be better off, you don't need to force them to do that. And if, and so, there you go. Okay, let me switch. Somebody else is posting the Q&A. So Don says, the U.S. runs a large trade deficit with other countries, and the federal government has a large budget deficit. Do foreign government buying our debt have a negative effect in terms of interfering with foreigners buying our exports? Fabulous question, Don. And that doesn't mean the other guy's question wasn't fabulous, but that's really a great question, Don, and I'm glad you brought that up. Let me see. Okay, we're going to 30 after. Okay, we got plenty of time. Don, I don't want to remember the difficulty, guys, is that in this course, some of you are retired. You're in your 60s, and you've been business owners, and so you know all this kind of stuff in terms of finance at the household business level, and then you just want to learn, well, gee, how do economists look at it at the macro level? And so that's one kind of person. But then I've also got homeschoolers who are 12 years old taking this course, right? So that's the difficulty I face. So let me not get too much into the weeds, Don, but what you're saying is exactly correct. So what this is actually called, if you want to go Google it, Don, and read more on this stuff in addition to the quick answer I'll give you here, it's I think if you Google twin deficits, you'll hit that. And that was a sort of a catchphrase. I think it came into vogue in the 1980s, because that was when the U.S. federal government began running historically large budget deficits in peacetime. Okay, so if you look at the scope of U.S. fiscal history, U.S. federal government fiscal history, it's generally speaking, of course generalizing, but they would run humongous budget deficits during wars, but then pay down the debt during peacetime. All right, that got a little bit messed up after World War II. They certainly ran up a huge debt, and then they kind of just treaded water. You know, it's not like they ran big budget surpluses, but they didn't. It was more they kind of just treaded water, and then the economy grew, and so the debt as a percentage of GDP fell, but the absolute amount. But earlier than that, like after World War I, so in the 1920s, I mean, Calvin Coolidge ran a budget surplus every year he was in office. Okay, so he was literally paying down the debt, and that was when there was a boom period. You might think they'd be profligate and start spending, but no, he was, because especially when they were still on the gold standard, the idea was the government is just like a really big business. And so, yeah, it has the capacity to run up a huge debt during an emergency like a war, but then in the good time, during peace, you've got to pay that down. Whereas nowadays, people think that there's something qualitatively different about the government, and that the government should never pay down its debt, or a lot of people, not Austrians, but a lot of people think like that. They think the rules of finance that pertain to a household or even a giant company, for some reason, are reversed when it comes to the government. But in any event, that changed in the 1980s. And it was in the 1980s, if you look like at a chart of the U.S. government, federal government debt during the 1980s is when it really started growing. Nowadays, with our perspective, the budget deficits under the Ronald Reagan administrations seem like child's play. But that's just because they, you know, they've been so much surpassed by George W. Bush and especially Barack Obama. But back in the 1980s, it was scandalous. The size of the budget deficit that the government was running when the country wasn't even at war. You know, it's kind of like saying, yeah, when we're fighting Nazi Germany, this is going to be okay, but what the heck? And at the same time in the 1980s is when you really saw the U.S. trade account deteriorate, if you want to use that language, right? So that the trade deficit got really big and was just persistently big in the 1980s. And so critics of the Reagan administration and of the supply side policies, I think, coined this term of the twin deficits. And so that's what it sticks. So to answer your question, Don, yes, there is a connection, and historically, or in terms of policy discussion, people do make that connection. So there is, let me just walk you quickly through the mechanics of it. Yes, other things equal, if the U.S. federal government runs a budget deficit, if it borrows more money to spend than it takes in tax revenue, other things equal, you would expect that to worsen the trade deficit. Okay, and so there's different ways of seeing it. Let me just try to give you a flavor for it. Why don't I say that? And again, so if you're a homeschooling kid, I'm not going to quiz you on this stuff. This is just more for if you're really geeky and an overachiever and whatnot. So strictly speaking, when you look at the international trade accounts, the overall balance of trade is always in balance. Okay, and what I mean by that is if there is a deficit or discrepancy in terms of the exchange of goods and services, that's what's called the it's technically called the current account. Right, so the trade account is one component of the current account, and then there's the flip side of the current account is the capital account. Okay, and so the current account plus the capital account always balances. And I'm going to fudge a little bit because I don't want to get too complicated. Let's make it sound like it's the trade deficit and then the capital account. But like I said, I'm fudging a little bit to keep it simple. So the idea is if the U.S. buys more goods from China than vice versa, intuitively, it's like more dollars are flowing to China than vice versa. So it's like China sends the U.S. a bunch of TVs, and the U.S. sends them dollar bills. Okay, now, what is China going to do with those dollar bills? Well, they're not probably going to just literally increase their holdings of actual U.S. currency. Instead, what they're going to do with that, if they don't want exports from the U.S., you know, they're like, yeah, we bought their wheat, we bought some of their software, but you know what? We've got this extra $500 billion that came in because they wanted to buy our TVs and lamps and things like that and clothes. And we got this extra $500 billion that our people just don't want to spend on U.S. exports. So what are we going to do with it? Well, they could buy U.S. assets. Okay, so that's not an export. Okay, so let me just say that again. If the people in China spend $500 billion buying wheat from U.S. farmers, then that's a $500 billion export from the U.S. Right? We're selling goods and services in exchange for money to foreigners. But if instead the Chinese say, we've got this $500 billion, why don't we buy stocks in U.S. companies? And so they go and they buy $500 billion worth of, you know, GE stock and Microsoft and IBM or whatever, Google. Then they're buying stuff, but that doesn't count as a U.S. export. What that is just like it's a transfer of assets. Okay, and so that wouldn't reduce the trade deficit. right? That, that you still had a $500 billion trade deficit because we bought $500 billion more of their exports than they bought of our exports. But what I'm saying is the way that things balance in the grand scheme of things is they would acquire $500 billion on net of U.S. assets. Okay, so intuitively, like, forget about money. It's as if what's happening is the people in China are saying, yeah, we've got a bunch of TVs and clothes that we just made, and the Americans are saying, yeah, we want them, please. And the Chinese are saying, okay, well, I'll tell you what. We'll ship you these TVs and sweatpants and sweaters and stuff like that, but in exchange, we're going to become partial owners of your company. How's that? Or we want to own some of your farmland, or we want to own some of the buildings in your country. All right, so that's what's happening. So you can see why some people are alarmed by that. That kind of sounds like you're selling your birthright or something. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to say. If the Americans want to buy more stuff from foreigners and vice versa, and they can't get people to send us their goodies by us making goodies in return, another option is to say, okay, well, we have a bunch of property here. What if we give you that? Okay, another asset that we can send over, I say we, like, because I'm an American, is a bond. Okay, so there what's happening is effectively we're saying, okay, tell you what, we really want the $500 billion of TVs. And we understand you don't need any more of our, you don't want any more of our Wii or the computer software, the movies that we make here. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll send you a promise that we sign. And every year for the next 30 years, we'll send you $1 billion. And then 30 years from now, we'll send you $500 billion that you can do with what you want with at that time in money. Okay. And so that's what they're getting in exchange. They're not getting ownership. They're not getting land, or they're not getting ownership in U.S. stock, but they're getting a legally binding promise from Americans that we are now on the hook to send you money. And so, strictly speaking, if they use that flow of stuff to buy U.S. exports, effectively what we'd be saying is, okay, tell you what, we really want your TVs right now. You give us $500 billion worth of TVs, and then we'll send you $1 billion worth of wheat every year for the next 30 years. And then at the end of that, we'll send you $500 billion worth of software and wheat and whatever else you want, trips to Disney World. Okay? So I'm trying to abstract from the money to get you to see, when we get immediate exports in exchange for bonds, effectively, that's just like taking present goods and turning it into a promise of, we will send you a flow of stuff over the next few decades. Okay, so that's effectively what happens. And so the trade bit accounts always balance when you step back and look at it like that. That if we are buying more exports from China than vice versa, and we have a trade deficit, that has a mirror image somewhere else. It's called the capital account. And so it means if the U.S. is buying more Chinese goods than the Chinese are buying American goods, it means the Chinese are investing more in U.S. assets than the Americans are investing in Chinese assets. Okay, so I hope you see that. So now, finally, Don, coming back to your question. So if the U.S. federal government runs a budget deficit, that means it is issuing more bonds. So people have to be willing to take in more bonds and hold them. And so to the extent that some of that extra issuance of debt from the U.S. government crosses the border and ends up in the hands of foreigners, then other things equal, necessarily, that means those foreigners, their country has to, on net, export more goods and services to the U.S. in that time period. Okay, so let me just say it one last way, and I'll move on. I'll totally get bogged down in this question. But so again, think of it. What you want to do is flip it. Don't think of it as like that exports are bad. Think of it as exports are good. that you want to get somebody, or I'm sorry, think of it as imports are good. In a very common sense way, that stuff coming into your country is good, right? So if we're going to give foreigners pieces of paper that pledge the U.S. government will send them tax revenue over the next 30 years, because that's what a bond from the U.S. government is. It's saying the owner of this piece of paper is legally entitled to payments coming from the U.S. Treasury. So the U.S. Treasury is going to go shake down American taxpayers, take money from them, and then send some of that to whoever's holding this piece of paper. Okay, so the point is, if the U.S. government is going to give some of those pieces of paper to people in China, saying, here you go, we're going to be shaking down Americans for the next 30 years and taking their money, and you want to cut of that, of the spoils? You want to split the wealth? Right, so if we're going to do that, well, the U.S. has to get something in exchange for that. We're not going to give those things away for free. And so the way the Chinese bid for those pieces of paper is to send us TVs. Again, I'm simplifying, but I'm just trying to get you to see the logic of it. Okay, so that it's not, you know, don't think of it as, oh man, the Chinese are able to get, you know, a favorable balance of trade. No, that's not the way to think. The way to think of it is, if you're going to be giving foreigners this very valuable asset that says we're going to be sending you money over the next 30 years, well, the foreigners got to give us something in exchange, and what they do is give us TVs. So if you didn't know anything else, the fact that foreigners are sending TVs into the homes of Americans, that's good for Americans, right? Because you're getting TVs. But there's a downside, of course, and that's that, oh, geez, now future Americans for the next 30 years are going to get taxed more to pay off this obligation. Okay, so that's the set of don in which other things equal, if the U.S. government runs up a trade deficit, that will tend to cause the U.S. I'm sorry, if the U.S. federal government runs up a budget deficit, other things equal, that will worsen the trade deficit. Let me do one last quick thing, and I'll return to your guys' question. Even there, I just want to point it out. Even though I'm trying to be careful, the language and the terminology that we use is still loaded. Like I just said, I heard the words coming out of my mouth when I'm answering Don, and I said if the U.S. federal government runs a bigger budget deficit, that will tend to worsen the trade deficit. I think that's what I said. Well, worsen. Right there, that's a loaded term. I'm saying it's bad if the trade deficit goes up. Okay, I should have just said that will increase the trade deficit. Okay, so with a lot of this stuff, it's difficult because if the trade deficit is really high because the U.S. federal government is running big budget deficits, well, then, yeah, I agree that's a bad situation and that's like a powder keg waiting to blow up. But it's not because trade deficits per se are bad. Rather, it's because, oh, if the reason the trade deficit is so high is that the federal government's running big budget deficits, well, that's the issue. That's the problem. Okay, so let me just give you an example. I probably should have said this in the lecture. It didn't occur to me. You can imagine that a bunch of Rothbardians get together and they have they buy some little island somewhere. You know, they get it from whatever, some foreign dictator or something. They buy the island, they get there, and they establish a complete laissez-faire society. And, you know, like there's a million people initially in this little island in the Pacific, and it has some natural resources and stuff, and people are picking coconuts or whatever. Maybe it's got oil, who knows. But it's total free market. It's like the world described in Rothbard's Four New Liberties. Okay, so this is the closest to a genuinely free society as far as libertarians use that terminology that has ever existed in human history. So what would happen if we just watched that little fledgling society? I don't want to call it country because that sounds like it's statist. That little fledgling society, what would that thing look like over the next few decades? Well, it would run gigantic trade deficits, right? Because presumably economic growth in this place would be phenomenal. They would have hard money, right? Their banking would be there you say there'd probably be certain banks that were 100% reserved for people who wanted that, and you know, okay, so the people there would be using gold and silver coins. The prices would be quoted in terms of weights of precious metals. Okay, so investors around the world would flock to this place. They would want to own, you know, the land in this place, because then there'd be all kinds of immigration there too, right? Because there would be no welfare state, and so all the immigrants coming to this place would be there to work, and they would just be real productive and boom, 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 right? So, you know, people who valued their individual liberty would move there, right? There'd be no drug laws and stuff like that. Okay, so I'm just saying this place would be a mecca. People around the world would be dying to get into this place. And so the land values would be rising very quickly as well, you know, the real estate crisis. Okay, so if you just think about it, what would you, if you were an alien looking down from space at this, what would you see? You would see all sorts of resources and humans from around the globe all just flocking to this little island in the Pacific, right? Because the people there, you know, somebody would buy a plot of land and want to build a huge apartment skyscraper because he would know, over the next few years, millions of people are going to flock into this place because, you know, there's no taxes on labor, right? There's no Social Security, there's no FICA. Social Security is part of FICA, but there's no FICA, there's no federal income tax, right? So even unskilled workers would come to this place because they would know the productivity of labor would be higher than no taxes. And so after tax, I'll make $40 an hour flipping hamburgers, all right? So entrepreneurs would know this place is going to be booming. This is going to just, you know, in a few years, this is just going to be a powerhouse. And so they would want to build apartments, but there's nothing there. It's a little dinky little island in the Pacific. So they would have to get cement and steel and glass and other things, computer boards and whatever from around the world. And that stuff would all get shipped to this little place, so that they could start building the apartment complexes and the factories and whatever else. You know, they probably would have a bunch of supercomputers and satellite connections and stuff, because it would probably become a financial hub. They would need to have, you know, good internet connection to be able to do transactions with banking centers around the world. All right? So the point is they wouldn't make all that stuff locally, because it's this island in the Pacific that's just got coconut trees. All that stuff would get shipped in from around the world. So I'm saying if you look at the trade accounts in this period of just massive growth and development, that would show up as massive trade deficits, because you would see millions of dollars or billions of dollars worth of lumber and steel and other goods flowing into this country. And the country would not be exporting anything, or wouldn't be exporting much. So the way that would get reconciled in the accounts is people would be gaining ownership in assets of this country. Like, so maybe they would be getting equity from the companies that were being founded, or maybe they would be getting bonds that somebody would be, like, if a guy's going to build an apartment complex because he's forecasting, oh, the next few years, millions of people are going to flock here. Well, they're not there right now. So the way he's going to pay for that is he's going to borrow from abroad, effectively. Right? He's saying, send me your lumber, send me your panes of glass, send me your steel, send me your concrete now. And then over the next few years, when I get a bunch of tenants in these buildings who are paying me rent, I will send, you know, I'll pay you off over time. And so in terms of the trade accounts, technically what's happening is they would be getting financial assets from this little dinky island. Okay, so the point, there's nothing bad about that. That's fabulous. That's what you'd want to have happen. That's progress. That makes total sense, that when you have this new opportunity in this place that has a rich environment, that capital from around the world produced things would flow in, and that the way that gets paid for and reconciled is financial transactions go the other way to be the mirror image. And so that would show up as humongous trade deficits year after year, as the rest of the world was sending more goods and services into this place than vice versa. But eventually it would flip, where maybe they would be running trade surpluses. It depends, but you get the point. So that's what I'm saying, is a trade deficit per se is neither good nor bad. it depends what the circumstances are. It depends where it's coming from. Just like with an individual household. Yeah, you can understand how, as a general rule, if you say, uh-oh, that household is consuming more than its income, it's spending more than its income, that sounds scary. But what if it's somebody just moved, what if it's a doctor, a brain surgeon, who just relocated to a new city, he's going to start his job in a month, and he's buying a house, and he's going around with his wife, getting furniture and stuff, and the movers are coming in and installing it into his house. And technically for that month, he's spending a lot more than he's producing. And so he's drawing down his assets. His net worth is decreasing. That's true, but that's fine. And you wouldn't say, what are you doing? Stop. Wait till you earn the income. That'd be crazy if month to month you were not ever allowed to run a trade deficit in terms of your household. Okay, so on the other hand, if the reason the household's running a trade deficit is because the person is unemployed and is just sitting around on the couch and borrowing money from his friends and his parents and just keeps running up a debt, and that's how he's getting food to come in and electricity and stuff. So that's his consumption, that's his spending, and yet his income is zero because he's sitting on the couch watching TV, and the way he's paying for the food and the electricity and stuff is he keeps running up his debt with his parents and his friends. Well, then there, the trade account or the trade balance still balances overall, that he's got every month, whatever, $2,000 of imports, food and electricity and rent. And then he's got $2,000 of people investing in his assets, namely the amount of money that he owes to other people goes up by $2,000 every month. So that's like saying the rest of the world is gaining more and more financial assets issued by this guy, namely his IOUs or his bonds. Okay, so that obviously is not a good situation. You'd say, whoa, you better turn that around. Do you see the difference there? That it's not the trade deficit per se, it depends on what the overall circumstances are. Okay, sorry, I went way longer on that than I meant to, but it seemed like it was relevant. Okay. Jed Martin says, upon completion of the three courses covering your Lessons for the Young Economist book, what 3 to 4 books would you recommend to tackle next? Is there any point reading Menger, or should I fast forward to Rofford's Man, Economy, and State? Okay, good question, Jed. I have done a broader reading list on my blog, and let me see if I can find that really fast. If you haven't read Man, Economy, and State, that's what you should tackle next. And have my study guide with you. I mean, you can get the PDF for free. Let's see, Robert Murphy, Libertarian Reading List. Okay, yeah, so I just went to Google and said Robert Murphy, Libertarian Reading List. I'm going to post this in the chat box, but in case somebody's listening to this and just hearing the audio. So let's see, I'll put this up here. Okay, so there in the main chat box there, Jed, I posted the list to explain. Because it depends what you want. If you want straight econ, there's one set of things to read. If you want more like libertarian political theory, there's another track. So anyway, I gave you a reading list there. But to specifically answer your question, yeah, I think if you've read Lessons in Economics and taken 3 courses here, then yeah, it would make sense. You're definitely ready, especially if you're saying you're older, to go ahead and get into Man, Economy, and State. Then I would recommend, if you get through Man, Economy, and State and you like it and you want more, the next thing I would do is read Mises, Human Action. Okay, because some people might say, you don't need to read that because Rothbard took all the econ of Human Action and said it in plainer language and elaborated on it. So, but that is true, but there's a lot in Human Action that's not really just econ. And so, and I think Murray Rothbard would be the first person, if you were alive, to tell you, just because you read My Man, Economy, and State, don't think you shouldn't go read Human Action also. But read Rothbard first, because it's easier. He's an easier writer for an English readers who get, because Mises kind of has formal journaling. Even though Mises writes it in English, it's still, it's a very formal style, and Rothbard's easier to understand. Okay, Jan says, I read your blog and I see you're big on climate change. I think you brought attention to some IPCC scientists pretty much admitting the debate is rigged. How many of them are there? What reaction do they get from the science is settled crowd? Yeah, okay. So just for people who don't know the context here, I'm a consultant. I'm not attached to any university or anything. And so I have a bunch of different clients. And obviously one outlet of my professional activities is I teach these online classes for you guys. But another main client I have is the Institute for Energy Research, which is in D.C., a free market think tank that focuses on energy issues. And so I'm their senior economist, I think is my formal title with them. So anyway, I have tended to specialize in economics of climate change while I've been working for them. So I have done a lot of reading on these computer models that economists develop that try to model the global economy and climate system and to say stuff like each ton of carbon dioxide emitted this year will contribute $40 of additional negative externalities and damage over the next 300 years if we discounted it at a 3% rate, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's the area where I've done a lot of work. And so what Jan is referring to specifically is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. They come out with these reports every few years. And the latest one, it came out in three stages. So the first section was like on the physical science that came out like last September. And then they had parts two and three, they're called the working groups two and three, that come out with then the economics of it and then what policies can governments do to address these issues. And so what I have been posting in my blog recently is after this latest one came out, two of the lead authors on different chapters who are economists and who are world-renowned experts on the economics of climate change. And so, and they both support a modest carbon tax. Okay, so these aren't guys who are like free market ideologues. These aren't guys who, you know, work for the Heritage Foundation or something and say, oh yeah, Al Gore's full of garbage. No, these are, one of the guys is at Harvard and he's like the head of, I forget the exact title, but he's like the head of Harvard's economics of climate change program, and this other guy, his host isn't as prestigious as that. And who the heck is he? I forget what country he's in. But he's, in terms of published, you know, peer-reviewed articles on the economics of climate change, this other guy is even bigger than the first guy. So their names are Richard Toll is the guy who's very published, and the other guy, I'm going to blank. I knew it once I went to say what his name was. Slip my mind. It'll probably come back to me the moment I turn off this lecture. But anyway, so those two guys were the lead authors of two chapters in the latest IPCC report. Okay, so it was their job to, what the IPCC is supposed to do is just synthesize the existing peer-reviewed literature. Okay, so the IPCC is not supposed to do new research. Rather, it's just periodically it's supposed to survey the field, get the experts in all the different areas, and say, give us a summary of what the consensus is right now, and we'll codify that and you know, boil it down and then present it to policymakers and the public so that they can be kept abreast of the latest developments, you know, in the cutting edge peer-reviewed research. That's the idea. So it involves, you know, so there's on the sections that deal with just the pure natural science, like to say what's happened with precipitation, what's happened with global temperatures, are there more cyclones now than there used to be, are sea levels rising? What's happening with polar ice caps? You know, those things that are just pure, straight scientific questions, physical science, natural science, you know, they have actual, those types of scientists in charge of those chapters. But the other chapters dealing with, okay, well, if the government put a $10 per ton carbon tax in place, but the U.S. and Europe did it, but China didn't do it, what does that do? What does the research say about that? You know, so that's a question for economists who are in this area, right? Somebody who just knows how hurricanes work can't answer a question like that. You'd say, oh, if there was a tax in place, what would that do to hurricanes years from now, right? Because you need to know how will firms react to this tax. You know, will they reduce emissions? Will they just move to China? You see what I'm saying? So you need an economist to answer. So anyway, these two guys are economists in this area, and they each had different chapters. And so their job was the one to go out and get all the different authors to help summarize their little thing. But they're the lead author of that chapter to sort of codify it all. So the point is, they did that, and they were happy with the results, you know, in terms of the chapter for which they were the lead author. I think for each chapter, there were two lead coordinating authors, okay? And so this guy, Richard Toll, him and some other guy, were the lead coordinating authors of this one chapter, and so they were happy with what they had assembled. They thought, yep, that accurately represents the current understanding among economists in this area for these issues. And then, but the thing is, these documents are humongous, right? Because there's all kinds of subject areas that go into this, and to summarize the literature, it's very extensive. And so they realize nobody's going to read that stuff. And so what they do is they then prepare what's called a summary for policymakers. And that's like a 40-page summary crystallizing the main points of what is otherwise like hundreds of pages worth of information. Okay, so the problem is these summaries for policymakers, the claim, this is what Jan is talking about, these guys, you know, these economists who are very credentialed, they worked on the summary for policymakers, they were happy with it. But then the way the IPCC process works, they go to this conference over the course of like 5 days. The academics, you know, the guys with either PhDs or whatever, they come and present the first draft that they have prepared. And then representatives from every government who's part of the IPCC come, and they have veto power. So they get to tinker with the draft and make suggested edits. And the only way the final draft or the final version gets published as part of, you know, the consensus report made available to everyone on planet Earth is that the representatives from every single government have to sign off on it. And so these guys were complaining, saying that totally distorts the message, that nothing that is awkward for any particular government can get published that way. And in particular, they're saying these same representatives are also, in many cases, the ones who represent their government at a different body where they haggle over the distribution of subsidies and revenues and things for, like, protecting your country from flooding, or subsidies to build solar power or whatever. Okay, so the point was, this is an awkward conflict of interest, that if you're a representative from some government and you're at this IPCC conference haggling over what the consensus science is going to be reported to the world, and you have veto power over it, if the science really says that flooding is not going to affect your country because, oh, actually, you know, the latest research is that flooding, you know, sea levels aren't rising as much as we thought they were 5 years ago. And you're in a month going to go to a different conference lobbying that your country should get $1 billion to help build coastal defenses against rising sea level. Well, you're going to veto that statement, right? Because, you know, if that statement gets in there, well, then you're not going to get $1 billion for your country. Right, and so their point was, this is a huge – it's not even like that they're dishonest. It's just, how can you expect somebody, you know, it would be like, this, like, why there's conflict of interest and why you recuse yourself. It's like if a judge were trying to be a judge in a murder case and his son was the defendant. And, you know, you would just, you'd have to recuse yourself. It's not that you would consciously lie, but it's just you can't be an impartial judge when, you know, you have such a vested interest in the outcome. The same thing here. So anyway, they were just going through and explaining how this process was totally politicized and that the version that, you know, the summary for policymakers that is all anybody ever reads except the true academics and nerds from these IPCC reports totally distorted the actual science and the peer-reviewed research in favor of what the governments of the world wanted to hear, because they're going to use this thing to then justify certain policies. And so it was so bad that this guy Richard Toll took his name off of it. And he said, yeah, keep my name on the chapter, but don't put my name on the summary for policymakers. I don't agree with this stuff. The guy's name was Robert Staven, the Harvard guy that finally came to me. Okay, so thanks for tuning in, guys. Oh, I see. Okay, Jan says, what about Menger? Is it worth it, or is it all including human action? To be honest, Jan, I have not read that much of Menger. I mean, I've read a lot from his Principles of Economics, the 1871 book that founded the Austrian school. I mean, I don't want to say don't read Menger, but in the grand scheme of things, I think if you're going to try to read older stuff, I would recommend reading Bombach more than Menger. And I don't even just mean his Capital and Interest here. I mean, like, Bombach's got a book on economic value. I forget the title. It's like Principles of Economic Value or something like that. I think Bombach is a more systematic thinker and really gets to the heart of something. Takes the subjective marginal framework that Menger invented, and I think Bombach refined it and just applies it more like a skilled surgeon, whereas Menger is not so precise. All right, so I feel funny saying that. I know it's coming off like I'm saying don't read Menger, but it's partly because I have not read as much Menger, so I don't know. I have not read his book cover to cover. And so, whereas I have read Bombach's stuff, and I know that it's great, and there's a lot of stuff in Bombach that you're not going to get from even Human Action or even Rothbard, that it's certain ways of thinking that it just, like, it really crystallizes something. Oh, like, for example, A Critique of the Marxist System. There's a Bombach book called Karl Marx and the Close of the System. There's stuff in there that you don't see anywhere else in terms of just seeing, you know, not just a Marxist system about, oh yeah, you don't want to expropriate property, but no, like Marx's actual scientific explanation, theoretical explanation for where profit comes from, how, it's skimmed off the top of the workers. Bombach just walks through and blows that up. And I had not seen that done so systematically, even in Mises' writings. Okay. Let me stop there. So thanks everyone for tuning in, and I will see you guys next week.